Do you think life is simpler as time evolves? For some, it can be more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Tucker Allen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. We're continuing to focus on the subject of the coronavirus. We know that it's on the front of your minds. It's in our face every time we cut on the TV. We know that in addition to the health concerns, there are financial and economic concerns. And for some people, the financial and economic are as important as the health. I would challenge that in terms of our values. But the bottom line is, you know, we have expenses that continue. We have obligations. And for some people, their sources of income may be dramatically reduced over the next several weeks, maybe months. So there is, I think it's fair to say, almost as much fear regarding what are the financial and economic consequences as even there is regarding the health. So today we're going to focus on the financial and economic. Jill, would you tell our listeners who our guest is today?
Yes. We have Peter Lazareth with us. He's the co-chief investment officer for PlanCor. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Jill and Joe.
And the willingness to gather into this studio, we may be in violation of national policy here.
Social distancing. We're not 6 feet away from each other.
Well, we could create a little more magic and pretend we're all in glass rooms and then they won't know. But now they're in on the secret of the intimacy we have here.
You know, it's just such a crazy world. And it's a world that we've really only started to come to know in the last almost 7 days, maybe 14.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, panic that's out there.
We read about and heard about coronavirus from a distance, you know, over there, China.
Yeah.
So we're hearing about it and we're thinking, boy, that's interesting. And many of us are saying, you know, that's of significant concern. But there's nothing that rises to the level of concern when it becomes something that you're living with every day.
When it's in your face.
In your face, in your neighborhood. You know, you attend church or synagogue or whatever and look around you and there's half as many people or a third, or maybe they closed.
Well, the archdiocese.
Yeah.
Did you hear the archbishop has suspended masses?
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
So I know probably more than 50% of the Protestant churches have canceled services. Our church met this past Sunday, but I looked around the room. And in every pew, people were sitting about, 3 to 6 feet apart.
Yeah.
They were very widely dispersed. And it was just almost a solemn feel in the congregation. It just felt different. And people weren't shaking hands.
Right.
You know, people were reluctant to hug, which is something that's relatively common among our members. So things are different. Have you noticed this, Peter?
Yes, and you see it even just when you're outdoors and you're going to pass somebody on a sidewalk and maybe you hug the edges of that sidewalk a little bit more. And the grocery store, I know there were a couple days where it was chaos in the grocery store in terms of number of people. And in the last 3 days, I've been to the grocery store twice. And one time I was there when it was crazy. And then one time I went at 6 a.m. and there was nobody there. However, the few people who were there, we all were keeping a little bit more distance. But I will say that I think people are being a little more friendlier and a little more patient and understanding. You know, we're all experiencing this together. And I do see a degree of civilness and camaraderie and understanding, like, this is going to be difficult if we all have to stay put in one place for a couple weeks or a couple months.
This isolation.
So, yeah.
You're right. I think there is this sense of, you know, we're in this together. Mm-hmm. And I would agree. I think I've noticed, too, that positive change in people's attitudes. So a little bit about your background, Peter. Your background, of course, is financial and economic. You're a certified financial planner. PlanCorp, I think many of our listeners have probably heard of this company, considering it's based in St. Louis, it's in a number of other cities, and you are one of the CIO's chief investment officers. So among your responsibilities, I assume, is not to just make decisions about particular companies, but to prognosticate about broader economic trends. And to look at the economy, for example, and try to get some sense where things might be headed. So have you been following this coronavirus as it relates to the economy and in the financial world?
Yes, it's hard not to at this point, especially because markets are down so much so quickly. So let me take a step back here. We've had a couple of the worst trading days in market history, and it all has happened in a span of less than a week and a half. And so it's hard to ignore this. And I think what is really interesting, you mentioned the prognosticators. People who have to predict the future for a living typically do a poor job, because whether it's predicting sports or politics or markets, prediction's just not that easy.
It's tough.
Sure. It's basically impossible. But I will say what's interesting is one of the parts of my job that I do is every December and January, a bunch of year-end outlooks come out. So in all of the big wirehouses, all the big research shops, they put out their 2020 outlook. Nobody had something like this as the reason for a market fall.
It's not in any company's budget.
No.
Yeah. This is not priced into our projected earnings.
No.
At Cordell and Cordell or Tucker Allen.
Well, a few months ago, we would have never imagined anything like this.
And that's, I think, the really important lesson from a long-term perspective. And we're going to focus on some more near-term stuff. But when you remember, when you worry about the market in general and you have very specific reasons you're worried about it, you got to remember that there are millions of market participants out there pricing in information every single day. And it's the thing that we're not talking about that is the big risk, the big concern. And oftentimes, whether at the end of 2019 you were concerned about the trade war or you were concerned about just the political climate, or you're concerned that we're at all-time market highs, you could go down a big list of things. Nobody said novel virus would be the reason that we would have a downturn. And that's a good long-term lesson to remember, that if it's a piece of information that everybody knows about, chances are the market's pricing it in. And what we're seeing with these big, big market swings is the market's trying to figure out what's the future look like. So without getting overly technical about it, market prices are just a reflection of future corporate profits. And if you don't know when companies are going to be able to up and run, it makes it hard to project future profitability. And so if I think with the coronavirus in particular, what's really interesting is originally we thought, okay, this is going to be a China issue. Maybe it'll be an Asia issue as it started to spread. And there was some international and emerging market selling going on. Not so much in the U.S. Once it spread to Italy, you know, the cat kind of got out of the bag, and now it's here in the U.S. And there's a lot of, you know, we're being very proactive. And in China right now, the peak contraction rate, we've peaked, and they're able to go back to work, and we're seeing how that economy is already starting to pick up again.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the United States, we're kind of just getting started. But if you're projecting future stock prices and you have to say, well, when will it be contained? Will it be contained? Will there be cure? We can't know when things go back to normal. But I do think that the sentiment is that things will go back to normal at some point. In the meantime, you'll see stock prices moving back and forth as new pieces of information come out and you get those market participants pricing it in.
And don't you think, though, that there's a relative confidence that this thing will become less of a crisis as soon as 8 weeks from now? I mean, when you look at the rate at which China processed through those very dire stages of this, now, albeit they did it, you know, with a dictatorship and lots of harsh martial law. But the point is, they managed to cycle through that very, very precarious period in about, what was it, maybe 6 weeks or so? And I'm wondering if you know, we don't have the martial measures, but we do have a very smart population, a more educated population, at least compared to Hubei province, I think. And I think that we're not living in as close a proximity to each other. We're, you know, those in Wuhan apparently were in circumstances where they lived very closely. So I'm wondering, can we not expect in another 6 to 8 weeks, not to be rid of this, but for those big scares that haunt us to be in the rearview mirror?
Well, I certainly think that people hope so. Now, I personally don't know, and none of us can know. I would like to think at the end of 8 weeks, restaurants are open again. Businesses are running.
But will people
still be contracting the virus? Yes. The thing is, we're all talking about trying to flatten the curve because our hospital system can't afford to have everybody get sick at the same time.
So flattening the curve, you should mention what that means.
Yeah. So flattening the curve, really, if we all were to get infected right now, it means that we would all, you know, a lot of hospital beds would be taken up by people with the coronavirus, whereas, you know, someone in critical condition might not have a room to go to or a doctor to see. And when you self-quarantine, or when you actually quarantine, the speed at which people get infected spreads out. And so instead of everybody getting infected at once, you spread it out. Flattening the curve is spreading out the infection rate over a longer period of time. Yeah. And I have this bell curve in my head, which makes it really tough to explain. But really, you're just spreading out the rate at which people are infected. And what that does is it makes it less stressful on our healthcare system, which is quite good.
You know, people,
right. That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, you go to a lot of these other countries and you might be waiting months for care, or you might not get care at all. So on the plus side, we have a great healthcare system. Sure, there are challenges there, but overall, let's be happy with what we have.
Yeah, we are.
Right.
And as long as we don't all get infected at the same time and all need the same, we don't have enough hospital beds for everybody in America.
And you would say the same would be true for the economic side. To the extent that we weren't disabled as a population all at once, then the economy gets to continue on its way.
Right. And here's the thing we're looking for. We're looking for the CDC to say we have peaked in terms of our new infection rate. So China's gone through the peaking process, and we think that they have peaked now. And now they might start trending in the right direction.
And they have been.
Yeah. And we're hoping that the United States, you know, most people are saying 8 weeks. We don't know if that's enough. Let's hope it is. And I think if the moment that we do have a sense that the infection speed has peaked, that doesn't mean people haven't stopped getting it, but it does mean that the rate of change is not increasing, then that's going to be the point in time where you can say, okay, so now I can suddenly start projecting future profitability of companies. I can now confidently go buy securities and understand what sort of risks I'm taking. And risk and return are so tightly related in markets. When you can understand the risks, then you can appropriately price what a return should be. And I think that's sort of that key metric that markets want to see. When has the United States hit that peak rate? When have other major economies hit that peak rate? We all hope it's 8 weeks for a number of reasons, financially, physically. You know, I think emotionally and mentally, people will deal with isolation differently. Will 8 weeks be enough? I sure hope so. Maybe it'll be 4 weeks. Maybe it'll be 12 weeks. I don't know. But I've been really impressed with the speed with which we did. I don't know that we took it seriously the first week it was in the United States, maybe. That's my own personal opinion.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the response has changed a lot. I think it would help to get a really shock and awe type fiscal package. And I say that without a political bent. I'm just saying that when the Federal Reserve, who's our, you know, provides our monetary policy, they made some monetary accommodations for markets, but lower interest rates can't help keep an airline from going out of business, or restaurants from closing down, or people collecting sick leave. You know, we need some fiscal support here too. I don't know what the right number is, but just looking at past fiscal packages during crises of all different sorts and sizes, it's usually a shock and awe number. That it's more about the psychology of it and people going, wow, we're going to really get helped here, for markets to then feel comfortable.
And Peter, you mentioned in your article about past epidemics, which of course this is a pandemic, have historically had short-term impact on the stocks. Okay. But with this, with the coronavirus, again, it's unprecedented. Do you believe the impact will only be short term if, you know, we see a peak, say, in 8 to 10 weeks, something like that?
Well, I think that let me say that I personally feel like we're likely headed for a recession in this instance, and recessions have all different shapes and sizes. And you know, everyone remembers the last recession was nearly 18 months and it was really, really harsh because there were some structural imbalances that needed to be fixed.
You're talking about 08.
08, great financial crisis. Yeah. October 2007 to March 2009, it was a mess. And it took a lot of those imbalances to work themselves out. Here's what we have going for us that's really great. Economic data was looking good. You know, unemployment had never been lower. Inflation is low. The manufacturing sector, which had been a big laggard in the recovery, was starting to show signs of life. This is going to take time to recover. It takes time to people to all be well, to get things up and running again. I think it's short-lived in the sense of an average recession. You know, if I had to predict, is this an average length recession? I would say it's probably a below average length. It's more disaster relief. You know, you look at past disaster-caused recessions. 9/11 is an example.
Right.
You know, there's a disaster, a single event that couldn't have been predicted and had nothing to do with structural imbalance in the economy. But
exogenous.
Yes. And so that's the sort of way that I view this particular instance. And we won't know. I think it's tempting, you know, long-term investors, people who are really experienced, seasoned investors, they see big losses and they probably, more often than not, this isn't everybody, they say, this looks like a great buying opportunity. Now, of course, when you're in retirement and you're not earning a full income, maybe you have Social Security or you have benefits, but you think, well, how am I supposed to take advantage of this opportunity? Maybe your mind shifts a little bit, but you should have at least, you know, in the last 40 years, we've had 13 corrections and 8 bear markets. That's basically one of these every other year. And so there's a lot of history you can draw on from, and they all look a little different. I think this will be short-lived personally in the sense of past recessions.
Because economically, we've been in good shape for a long time.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm. Let me play the other side of this
sure
question.
Thing.
Well, one thing, we've had levels of debt, though, that we've never seen. And those debts have just skyrocketed, both in terms of the federal debt as well as debt in corporate America. So our rates have been artificially low. So we've never had an experience like that in economic history, where you've had a Fed that has declared that rates are down either at zero most recently, the last move, but for all practical purposes, far below what the market would dictate. So there's been no price discovery, as they call it, regarding obtaining the cost of money to do investments and whatnot. So in a way, you might say that the stock prices before this at the Dow at $30,000 was the result of a cost of money that was artificially low. So one of the challenges, I think, is for the Fed to ever allow the market to determine interest rates, and how do you get there, for fear that if they ever let up on the gas pedal, that we go into this deep recession. And so one could argue that something had to come along to cause a severe correction. And if it hadn't been this, it would have been something else.
Sure.
And that there was some discomfort in the economy despite its continually rising prices. The problem is that what has accompanied this is more of the thing that people were uncomfortable about, which was the Fed printing more money, stimulus, easing, all those things. And so what we get now when we have this black swan event is we get more of that. So I'm wondering, how do you tease out the part of this economic crisis that is attributable truly to this virus versus that part of the crisis that, yeah, the virus was the catalyst, no question, but was a problem in and of itself, and it needs to be solved?
It's a great question and point. So there's really never, we tell our clients at PlanCorp all the time, there is never the degree of causality that you see in the newspapers. You know, it's not A caused B. You know, the markets are more complex than that. There are millions of interconnected
multiple
parts.
Factors.
Right.
And, you know, even if you replay history over 10,000 times, the way that those different pieces interact will be a little bit different. And so there's a lot of bits to unpack in your statement. And so let me start with the Fed and interest rates. So they are, well, actually, let me start with the government debt. That was one of the first things you mentioned. It's never been as high. So a lot of things that we talk about is denominator blindness, where, yes, our national debt has never been so high, but our national assets have never been so high. So if you look at the country's asset level relative to our debts, the growth has been astronomical. You know, because we're still, our real estate is very, the government is still the largest real estate owner in the United States. Now, I'm not advocating selling a national park to China anytime soon. However, you can't take the overall debt level without thinking about what is the asset level too. And our country's assets are quite strong, much stronger than anybody seems to pay attention. But it's not to say the debt is irrelevant. What is more relevant than the total level of debt is the rate of change in the level of debt. In the level of debt, it's actually really the rate of change in the rate of change. So it's what we call the second derivative, and we don't want to necessarily get into that. But what matters most to markets is if there was a significant increase in the rate of change, that is more concerning than the absolute level. And the Fed does control the overnight rate, but ultimately they go to auction and China's a big buyer. Banks and institutions are a big buyer. Other central banks are big buyers. They're the ones setting market rates. They are historically low.
At least relative to the dollar.
Yeah. I mean, in the treasury market, and it's part of why the dollar is the reserve currency. It's part of why nobody is remotely
Everybody wants the dollar. It's amazing.
And there was a concerns maybe like 5 years ago, would the Chinese yuan replace the dollar? But less than 1% of global transactions are settled in Chinese currency. That's a problem. And you have to have people own your debt to be the reserve currency. Someday, could there be a second reserve currency? Possibly, but there is not anybody remotely close to that status right now.
And that deserves mentioning again for people to note this, that there's a lot of concern out there, especially among certain subcultures of the web and those who tend to be, I don't want to say doomsdayers, preppers, just maybe people who are very skeptical
sure.
about the future and mm-hmm. about the Fed's role, and there are a lot of those.
Yeah,
One answer to people who say, whenever you print this much money, we know, if we know anything else from a million years of human history, is that it's got to result in inflation. Why hasn't it? And I've concluded that it's for the reason you just gave, is that there is demand for the money. And as long as you have more demand than supply, then something is going to keep its value or gain its value. And the dollar, despite the printing press is running as they mm-hmm. are more now
right.
during this crisis, if the world is saying, give me more of those dollars, then that supply is being soaked up because the dollar is sought after. So yep. it doesn't produce inflation until you get to that point where yeah. you have more dollars than demand, right?
Right. And the demand is driven partly by quantitative economic things. People have account surpluses. They need to go put that money somewhere. They buy U.S. treasuries. And as a result,
they trust the treasuries.
They trust it. And that's the second piece is psychology. So let's say they didn't trust the Fed. And the Fed is saying, we want inflation to be 2%. We'll do whatever it takes. And Paul Volcker did a great job of saying, hey, if inflation gets crazy, we'll do something very uncomfortable.
In the early 80s.
That is a very important thing, because if you don't trust that the Fed would squash inflation and cause a recession just to keep inflation down, well, then maybe interest rates would be higher. But I think the fact that markets reflect low interest rates shows that they have confidence that the Fed would protect us from inflation.
Yes.
And your point is not wrong. You put a bunch of money and it sloshes around the system. If there's not enough people to soak up that money, you get inflation.
Sure.
But having confidence that somebody will take away the punch bowl, that's really important, as is the fact that, generally speaking, when you look at long, long, long-term trend in interest rates, these low interest rates, they are not the aberration from history. It's actually the 80s. So that big spike in interest rates, that was unusual. And so retirees have mostly lived, the last 30, 40 years have lived through a period of slowly falling interest rates from an unusually high peak. That was the weird moment in history, not necessarily where we are today. Now, we go negative. That is weird. Well, I'm not discounting it, but you look at the long-term trends and why people price risk the way they do. There's more transparency. There's a rule of law here in the United States that should be able to be relied upon.
Your point's well taken. For example, with South America, I mean, that's an example of why they print currencies. It produces runaway inflation. Argentina, for example. And it's producing that inflation because there's not demand for those dollars. And as you said, you would say there's distrust of that government policy.
They've defaulted so many times on their currency.
Yeah.
But we can go and buy the debt because we're the reserve currency. So we can't default. Now, it is a confidence game. If the whole world gives up at the exact same time, that would be a problem. But every contract's in dollars. I mean,
then you go to gold.
Yeah.
But every single commodity contract is in dollars. So you have 30-year contracts. It would take decades to roll off the dollar being the reserve currency.
And one more point, too, is that it's not about absolute confidence. It's about relative confidence.
That's correct. Yes.
Meaning the world could think that we are not to be trusted, but they believe that everyone else can be trusted even less. And that means we win in terms of the currency war. So really, it's all about relative confidence.
Yeah. And let me give you a really great example about that and how it works in all markets. So if we were to take out ads in every newspaper in the country and we put 100 photographs of men and women up there and we told anyone who is subscribing to these papers, whoever picks those who are deemed to be the most attractive, the 6 most attractive of these 100 people, they'll win $1 million. And so we're all going to play the game. The goal isn't to pick who you think is the most attractive.
Yeah.
The goal is to pick who you think the average person thinks is attractive. Now, Wall Street's playing this game, and they're all really smart. They understand that's the rules. So now you don't just try to pick who the average person thinks is attractive. You try to pick who the average person thinks the average person thinks is attractive. Now, this is why it is so hard to predict the future. And you mentioned there are corners of the internet with certain beliefs. The internet is really smart. It has a way of guiding you towards your existing beliefs. So does the news, the news stations on TV. And so the concerns that people have, regardless of where they are in life, the thing I would emphasize is just remember there are millions of people out there and they are moving trillions of dollars. So institutions make up 95% or more of the trading. Individuals like us don't really move the needle. And so it's important to remember that kind of concept of what the average person thinks the average person thinks. It's not about what you individually think.
Right.
That's not going to end up making a big difference.
And with market drops, it's unavoidable when it comes to investing. It's more how you respond to it.
Yes. So I think of
what are you telling your clients?
Right, right.
I'm sure market a lot losses. Of them are panicked.
Yeah. The ones who haven't been with us as long are maybe more panicked than those who've lived with us through past recessions. We've been in business 36 years. We've certainly handled our fair share of downturns before. But market losses are very normal. We try to tell people that during times of gain so that when they come, they're not surprised. The 10% drops happen in 65% of calendar years, and roughly a quarter of those turn into a 20% drop or bigger. So they're very normal. They're actually the cost of higher expected returns in stocks that versus bonds or cash. So I'd mentioned earlier, risk and return are very closely related. You take more risk by giving a company your capital, you would demand more return for taking on a greater risk. The thing about market losses is we are hardwired to react to danger or threats. So imagine the three of us, you're cavemen and women, and we hear a rustle in the bushes. One of us maybe stands to calculate the probability that rustle is a lion versus the wind, and the other two of us run off. The person who sat there calculating if it was a lion, the probability, that person got eaten. Evolutionary, they did not move on.
Yeah, and another way to express that thought is, and I've heard it said this way, is imagine a movie theater. There's one person that suddenly gets up and goes running out of the theater during the middle of the movie. I mean, there's nothing else going on except one person jumps and runs out. Would the other people run out of the room? Probably not. And I think this ties in with those instincts, those herd instincts you described. But there's a tipping point. If two people jumped up and went running out of the theater, then probably still you wouldn't see a response. But there's a tipping point where we're trained by our instincts over millennia that even though we don't hear it and maybe we don't see it, but there's a point where we see enough of the herd, so to speak,
right,
that starts to run, and we all start running. And when you and that's that effect in crowds where it you don't know what that number is. It could be 4 or 5 people. It could be 6. But there's a low number. It's not 50%.
The stores are all out of toilet paper.
I was thinking the same thing. Go to the grocery stores. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no toilet paper because all of a sudden people decided that there's no more toilet paper. I better grab one of those last few things. And now there's really, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's deeply ingrained in our DNA. And you think the scientific revolution was only 500 years ago. So us as a species that have been around for millions of years have not dealt with data before. And so when it comes to market losses, our natural instinct is to react. We want to do something. And my advice usually is to say, rather than look to your portfolio to do something, the best thing is to go to your financial plan, which has a lot of inputs in it that you can control. You can't control the market, can't control this coronavirus. You can control the inputs to your financial plan. And if you review those underlying assumptions to your financial plan, if those have changed, then you need to make an adjustment. But a good financial plan would have taken market losses into account. You should expect them to occur with the same frequency and magnitude as the past. You just never know when and why. And so typically with clients, we're just coaching them, go look at the plan. If you take an action with your portfolio, more likely than not, that action is going to be regrettable because the best performance tends to follow the worst performance.
So let's take a break now. When we come back, we're going to ask Peter what advice he has for those who are perhaps over 80. They might figure, hey, I don't have that horizon of recovery that people keep talking about that these 20 and 30-somethings have. So what advice can you give me? I have a portfolio now that's down, you know, 40, 30, maybe close to 40%, between 30 and 40%, many of you. So let's see what advice Peter has for us. Back in a moment with Elder Talk.
You're listening to Elder Talk with Tucker Allen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
We're back with Peter Lazaroff. Peter, we were talking about this whole financial, I'm tempted to use the word mess. I'm not going to do that. This whole financial situation associated with the coronavirus. And I want to try to drill down and be as specifically helpful as we can to those that I think are in significant numbers among our listeners, those in their 70s, 80s, and even beyond. So for those people whose horizons may seem a little shorter than others, what advice are you giving people who presumably didn't sell at the top? And so they're still holding stocks, which today are worth maybe 30 to 40% less. What advice do you have for those people?
Well, let me start with what we tell our clients who are 70 and above. They had the big benefit of having a financial plan in place, and the most important decision with that plan on the investment side is the mix of stocks and bonds. And so if you need money in the next year, you need to have it in cash or something very safe. You probably could handle these downturns because you know that every few years the market's down 20, 30%, certainly once a decade.
So let me interrupt you. So you're saying then that people who have enough money coming in from other sources, like maybe it's a fixed income, whether it's Social Security or some other reliable source.
Pension.
Sure.
That they may not have to touch this at this point.
That's right. And so this first part, and so I'm more speaking to the PlanCorp client, what we're telling those people, it's stay the course. We have planned for these downturns. Now, let's say you haven't planned for the downturn. You're in retirement, you have Social Security, maybe you're required to take minimum distributions from your IRAs. What should you be doing? Now, my first instinct, and this is ridiculously biased because I am a financial advisor, but I do think you should have an advisor. This is what they're good at. And certainly someone who watches it every day and is super informed can help come up with a plan that is specific to you. I think the tax opportunities of a downturn are very interesting, particularly if you're in retirement and your income is low. So we just had the Secure Act pass at the end of 2019, which changed some of the rules around IRAs. And if you're thinking of leaving assets behind for the next generation, you can use this downturn to your advantage.
How's that?
So I think one big strategy that has come up for people with IRA accounts, traditional IRA accounts, is that when you pass that account on to your heirs, you used to be able to take those distributions over a long period of time and stretch them out. Now you're going to be forced to take the distributions earlier in a 10-year period.
Unless
when
it's
your income's
spouse,
high.
Right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Spouse, that's not true. Good clarification there. So right now, you know, something like a Roth conversion, which was already attractive for tax management issues, becomes much more attractive from an estate planning perspective in terms of what you're going to pass to the next person. So imagine you have some losses in your taxable account. You can maybe realize some of those capital losses by tax loss harvesting, offset some of your income. You know, if you have a pension income that comes in, but you can look at how can I stay in the lowest tax bracket possible while converting assets while they're low, taking those distributions while your overall balance is low. And then so now you're not just lowering your personal tax liability for the remaining years of your life, you're also improving the tax liability for anyone who's going to inherit your assets. So I do think Roth conversion is a real opportunity here. And the other piece is tax loss harvesting, which I sort of mentioned in passing. So you have taxable assets. Let's just pretend the S&P 500. You got an S&P 500 fund, and it's down 25%. Well, you can sell that at a loss and buy back a similar large cap fund. Maybe you buy the Russell 1000. They basically go up and down by the same amount. So if U.S. large cap stocks start to rally, you'll get to realize that while booking this loss to offset other gains, to offset income if you do something like a Roth conversion strategy.
And so that people understand that it you can't simply turn around and buy the same stock within a certain period of time. So that's prohibitive. So that's the reason you're buying this
slightly
other,
different, yes.
Yeah, this sort of index that replicates that same bundle of stocks, for example. Otherwise, you would. You'd simply sell it, take your loss, and then turn around the next day and buy it again and wait for it to return to its price. And let me clarify again that you just made two great points, and I want to be sure they got that. The idea about harvesting your losses, getting tax benefits whenever you have tax-deferred assets, think of it as having your left and right hand. So if you have a traditional IRA, we'll call that your right hand. So in your right hand, you have these assets that the moment you pull them out, you know you have to pay taxes on. And some of you may, in fact, be doing that presently. So what this allows you to do when stocks are down 30-40% is to take that from your right hand, that traditional IRA, move it to your left hand, still your hands, move it to your left hand that's now a Roth, meaning it's an IRA that you've already paid taxes on. So mm-hmm. You move it to the left hand. You've not sold it. It's still yours. But guess what? Now you get to pay taxes on something that's worth maybe 40% less than it was. So now you have it in a much better position in some ways than it was in before this crash. Because if you were to take before the crash the after-tax value of that money, depending on your bracket, it's not this. You can't simply look at the sales price of the stock then versus now. You have to say sales price after taxes then versus now. And the point is that the difference isn't that great. So now you have a chance to move that from your right hand future taxes to your left hand, pay taxes now at this low number. That's really a smart strategy. And I don't hear many people talking about that, Peter.
Yeah, well, I'm really fortunate that I work at a place that started as a financial planning firm. You know, in 1983, we didn't even invest money. We were only doing financial plans for a flat fee. And so it's kind of in our culture at PlanCorp. And now that we're talking about the more advanced tax and estate planning strategies, I'll let your listeners know I built something called startmyplan.com. It's 9 questions. It will point you to resources that are most relevant to you. And stuff like this Roth conversion strategy or strategies on what to do with your RMDs if you don't need them, or even how to make the most out of
RMDs.
Yeah, required minimum distributions okay. from your IRAs. Thank you for keeping me straight there. I can't go too jargony here, but if you go to startmyplan.com, what it will do is give you these resources where you can be more confident that we're getting the facts right on the strategies and see what's right for you. And I do think that everyone should pay their taxes, right? I mean, we believe that you should pay the IRS tax bill.
But not a nickel more than you have.
But don't,
right.
Don't leave them a tip.
Thank you.
There's no need to
leave
them a tip.
Yeah.
Pay your bill. Don't leave a tip. And I think that downturns offer you a lot of opportunity to make lemonade out of lemons, whether that's from selling things at a loss in your taxable account, whether that's converting IRA balances to Roth IRAs. You know, I think if you're looking at your portfolio, and there's a part of that, and you know, I see this more with people in their 80s, and they say, look, there's this piece of my estate, my net worth that's not really for me. It's for my kids or my grandkids. You might consider, even if it's in a trust, you can just open up another account in that trust and make it more aggressive. Let it match the time horizon of the people whose money it's really for. So if you're never going to use it, why not invest it like a young person would? Because you know that you're ultimately leaving them for them and market prices are at such a discount.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left. I want to come back to the point you made a while ago that really, irrespective of the fact that you're a financial planner, your best advice is that people need to talk to a financial planner. And I know what you mean. You're a little self-conscious saying that. And I am sometimes as a lawyer when we're talking about estate planning issues because it seems self-serving. So I try to take myself out of the picture and say, look, let's assume you're not going to hire me. And in fact, many of you would not. I'm still telling you that my best advice to you is to go to a lawyer. And in this case, I'll tell you what many concerns are, my concerns and perhaps some of the listeners, is sometimes you go to what's called a financial planner. And really, this is somebody whose intention is to take the money, invest it. They get commissions. They get indirect ways of making money other than simply giving you the advice and doing the transaction. So what I really like, I have to tell you, and certified financial planners, I've talked on this show before, I think they have a marvelous credential. I think they have this very, very useful foundation of knowledge that allows them to give good advice. So I'm a big fan of CFPs. But I like CFPs whose focus is on hourly billing, where some people may think, well, gee, you mean the CFP is free? And I'm telling you, nothing is free. So, and you may push back.
Hiring an advisor is expensive. No, you're right.
Okay,
it's a big investment in yourself. Yes.
So here's where I'm going with this in this little time we have left is talk to people about how they can confidently go to CFP, maybe you, but go to a CFP. What is it that they should know to ask about how they'll be billed? But let me say before you answer that question, for anybody to say that I need help to solve my financial worth for the balance of my life, and incidentally, I don't want to have to pay you $300 an hour, whatever the number is, and maybe it takes 2 to 3 to 4 hours to do that, I think that that's unreasonable. I think people should be willing to pay for wonderful advice since it represents an incredibly small percentage of what you're trying to accomplish. But having said that, take us out of the show here with a couple minutes telling us what people should look for.
So the most important thing, in my opinion, is to look for someone who's acting as a fiduciary at all times, one, and two, will put that commitment in writing. Because if they don't put it in writing, there's no legs to stand on.
Right, very important.
Yeah, and I think it's something that you can go to, maybe you're working with an advisor and you say, like, hey, are you a fiduciary? And they'll say, of course, I have your best interest in heart. No, that wasn't the question. Are you a fiduciary?
Yeah.
Yes, I am. Will you put it in writing? If they want to ask compliance. No, you want your advisor their fiduciary commitment in writing. You want them to sign it. It's super important. And what's really confusing is I think people have become more educated on the different standards of care. But now there's duly registered advisors, which I think is even worse than where we were before 5 years ago. So you want to get that fiduciary commitment in writing. You want fee only. So what that means is really the only way that they earn revenue is from you, the client. So do you earn revenues from any referrals you make? You want them to say no. You don't want sales contests. You want to know that they're giving you advice that as long as you're doing well, they do well.
And not insurance commissions for their product.
Yeah. That's right. So like if everybody needs insurance at some point in time. So if we recommend a term insurance policy or a disability policy, we'll refer you out to somebody, but we're not getting a commission for that.
Yeah,
we're just doing that because that's a good part of a plan. So fiduciary commitment in writing and what we consider is fee only, no commissions.
Marvelous answer. Remember that. Ask the fiduciary question. It has great legal ramifications. Well, I hope this was helpful. Peter, we're going to have you back in the future.
And he has a great radio voice, doesn't he?
He does. And you're fond of information on top of it. So that's a hard combination, great voice and content.
Yeah.
So till next time, another episode of Elder Talk. Take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Tucker Ellen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Sponsored by Tucker Ellen, your estate and elder law advisors. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Tucker Ellen. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.